Is it just supposed to say? Can you listen to one more lecture on triage and protocols? See? Thank you. Thank you. Grazie. I am so very honored to be here in Florence. I brought four of my colleagues from Boston with me this time. And when I came to Florence last year, I fell so much in love with the country, and they had to listen to me for an entire year, and they said, "You're the boss, that's why you got to go." So I brought them with me. And also, you could hear them lecture each instead of me five times. We have been talking about triage and protocols, and we have discussed triage is very basic, simple, to sort. And we have applied very complicated methodology to triaging for many reasons. It's not just to sort anymore. The reason we have done this is because of volume, increasing length of stay in the emergency department, especially in the United States, but I don't think it's very unique to us. And also, we live in the United States especially, a very litigious society. If we make a mistake, we go to a court of law and spend many years and lots of dollars. The impact on how we do triage in the United States is very consumer-driven. The customer, patient's name now is customer, because they can choose where to get their health care. They pay for it with cash or credit or insurance, and they can choose where to go. They don't need to come to Beth Israel Deaconess anymore. Mine got translated. In ESI, the five-level triage, or any comprehensive triage program, experienced triage nurses have one main focus. It's to assign an acuity based on resources needed, as well as the patient's symptoms and chief complaint. And the goal, the United States gold standard, is that the RN, registered nurse, must achieve that information in 2 to 5 minutes. If not, and so how do we do that? We do not have the ability to see and treat in the same manner as the UK does, because we have a federal law that says anyone who presents to the emergency department in the United States for any reason must have a full triage and an assessment by a medical physician, licensed physician. We cannot send them away. If they want to leave, we have to sign forms that they relieve us of liability. And that's not even necessarily true. So we have to see everybody that comes in, and it causes problems. We have a different skill mix, and I'm not here to talk about that, but when you need to see someone in 2 to 5 minutes and decide what their acuity is, you need resources to do that. When the department backs up, you need someone else to assist you. So we have non-licensed assistants, they're called emergency department technicians, that help with vital signs and some of the laboratory testing, EKGs, etc., so the RN can gather the information and go on to the next. Vital signs. As you saw when Dwayne presented the ESI, vital signs are not the first thing that we do. And it's almost the same as the Careggi, an at-the-door assessment. You look and see, is this patient look stable or unstable? What is your report from the pre-hospital people? If they are in a cold situation, very acute, or an impending critical situation, they need to be seen right away. They go back to a room. There's no question. If they are a level 3, or verde, was in yours, they need to have vital signs so we can begin to see if there are 3, 4, or 5. All patients that go to the waiting area have to have a full set of vital signs, and that includes blood pressure, temperature, pulse, respiratory rate, and O2 saturation. Resources, just to go back on Duane's, resources are defined as the nature or number of tests, therapeutic interventions, consultations you might need or the patient may need that a presenting problem would need during the entire emergency department stay. Examples, laboratory tests, blood, urine, EKGs, x-ray, radiology films, CAT scan, MRI, ultrasound, if IV fluids are given, intravenous or intramuscular medications, specialty consultation, simple procedures like a Foley catheterization, and a complex procedure for nursing like assisting during conscious sedation. Somebody mentioned earlier that calling them protocols is a little difficult, very rigid. I know my chief of emergency medicine wouldn't let me write policy and procedures. I had to call them guidelines because they were too strict. And he's right. We need to look at judgment for nursing and for physicians in all of these types of care. Every patient is different. Our practices vary. But we want to achieve the same outcome. So we call them triage guidelines. And what triage guidelines really do in a nutshell is that it addresses the implementation of those predicted resources. We decided what we need to do on the patient, and how do we implement them. And this is according to that problem or chief complaint. That is how they're driven, our triage guidelines. They're also not necessarily triage. They're the first treatment that a patient receives, so they may be done in the triage area or they may be done in a patient room. The new challenge in the United States, and it sounds like everywhere, is that we have a capacity problem. Inpatient nursing areas are not able to take our patients when we've made a decision that they can be admitted. They don't go anywhere. They just stay in the emergency department. So we used to see 150 patients a day with an average length of stay of 4 hours, and that worked out pretty well. Now we see the same number of patients, and they have an average length of stay of 4 hours if they go home, and 12 to 16 hours if they stay. So the workload for nursing has increased 50% in the last couple of years. That's an amazing weight upon nursing. So, and also at Beth Israel Deaconess, we're what's called a tertiary level care. Our patients, 75% of our patients are level 3 and greater. Very small amount are non-urgent patients. So we do have an area where we triage them to called fast track, where we try to move them through with our protocols. But we end up with many complicated patients in the fast track area because we need the space. So we have a lot of conflict and a discussion about whether we can really achieve that. But the consumer, as well as our administrators, want us to fast track those patients on out. They don't work in the emergency department. Why do you want to create protocols? They're based on the gold standards of care, as Jill talked about. They're an effort to standardize treatment in each individual case. Very, very importantly, for our practice in the United States, it fosters a team. Emergency nurses and emergency medicine physicians are very dependent on each other. What we do at triage can affect the whole entire outcome for that physician and his or her care that they deliver. So these triage protocols are done with a team of physicians and nurses. Somebody in the United States has also done some scientific research. Our Emergency Nurses Association and the American College of Emergency Physicians, they have already set standards. It's our job to take them and implement them and apply them to our particular patient population and our individual institution. We are also measured in court, as I said, by law to that practice. If you deviate from standards of practice from one of these two organizations and something happens to the patient, there's a poor outcome, you have to explain yourself in court. And it is very unfortunate, but that is the way our society runs. additional effects. They create the interdisciplinary approach. We do believe, after research and study, that they improve the quality of patient care. They decrease the initial time to treatment. Again, I said throughput, or time to leaving the emergency department if they're getting admitted isn't necessarily improved by this. It also decreases your overall resource allocation. As I said, the amount of work on the nurse, the physician, and the whole team has increased because of the length of stay. So we need to make sure that we can do the best that we have, the most pointed work that we have, to identify the patient's problem, treat it, and do that quickly. And we need some kind of a protocol, and that's what we've done. So we found that we have been able to decrease overall resources, and we've made attempts to avoid unnecessary testing, which takes extra time, extra cost, and it's been proven to not necessarily affect outcome. However, I will be honest, we work in a teaching facility with residents, and some are from medicine program, some are from the surgical program, and then there's the emergency medicine program. And sometimes they don't read the protocols, and they order up. 3 days post minor medical motor vehicle accident, they get the entire trauma workup. And then they have to meet with me or Sue. Patient time in the department before disposition. Patient satisfaction, we do measure that, how happy patients are with their care. They don't necessarily, you might find this, they don't necessarily know if we've been as competent as we should be if there's a good outcome, but they know how nice we were to them and how quickly they got through our system. This is also supports nursing autonomy and professionalizes nursing practice. This is part of the nursing process. As you, our nursing education is based on the principles of assessment, planning, intervention, and reassessment. That's cyclical procedure or process. And this protocol implementation comes in that post-primary, post-secondary part of your assessment. Again, developed by an interdisciplinary team of nurses and physicians based on regional, national, professional standards of care. It's approved in our department by our leadership team. That's emergency management team, the nurse, and physician leadership. Our management team consists of the chief of emergency medicine, myself, the director of emergency nursing, two clinical advisors, chief of the residency program, and the manager of the secretaries and the registration clerks. They're in a written policy and procedures type of format, and we have educational comprehensive forums to educate everyone on this. They are also on our computer system. Almost done, I promise. Two more slides. The quality improvement process has to follow this. You have to continually monitor and make sure you're successful and that this is worth it. We look at patient length of stay, satisfaction, many quality markers that I won't go into, costs per patient, per diagnosis. Some examples, I just have two examples, and then that's really it. We're going to be spending some time in Careggi ED over the next 2 days, and we can talk some more. But this example, we had abdominal pain based on the symptoms, and then if the person's a priority one or two, they go back. They're undressed. They're seen by, it's very, very important that we communicate to the attending physician or to the senior EM resident immediately. We start, for abdominal pain is just an example, we start two large IV lines, 14 gauge, 16 gauge, fluids wide open. If it's a female, as I said, of childbearing age, we need to do a GYN exam immediately. And we start a variety of labs and urines. If they're non-urgent, we always make sure that they get disrobed. Physicians get very frustrated with us when patients, they go in to see the patient and they have to back out because the person's fully clothed. You think that wouldn't be an important thing to re-emphasize, but how many times do you think that happens? And finally, just an example of a patient that comes in with decreased level of consciousness, Again, priority, you decide if it's a one or two, they go right back. There's really a no or three here. and you notify again the emergency physician immediately and disrobe the patient. Vital signs, bilateral blood pressures on this one, that's our standard. Cardiac monitor, pulse oximetry, O2, and you can see on and on, IV. We give Narcan to see if we can release. We have a lot of, obviously, drug abuse. Even in the elder, it's not intentional abuse, but they have taken medications that have decreased. And we do a variety of labs. And I thank you very much for your attention. And I look forward to our continued relationship with Florence and Carigi.